4. Psalm 4, beginning in verse 1. Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart, more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety.
It's good to be with you this evening. We will be looking at Psalm 4. I appreciate those hymns of trust in God that Brian led us in. I thought after this morning's meditation on Luke 11 that we would spend a little bit of time looking at the prayer of someone who expressed absolute trust in God. So, a little bit about the psalm that Jacob just read for us. It is likely, or perhaps at least plausible, that the setting for this psalm is the same as the setting for Psalm 3, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Once again, David is facing a knight fleeing from his enemies, and he is expressing absolute confidence in God as he faces this knight, ultimately in peace, verses 4 and 5 and verse 8. The psalm is a prayer, and it is a prayer of trust. Trust occupies the structural center of the psalm, and it's bracketed by a section at the beginning and a section at the end where David's faith is contrasted with either his enemies at the beginning or those around him at the end of the psalm. And so I thought it would be, and hope it will be profitable for us to look at this prayer of faith. David begins, "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer." David cries out for God to answer him, to respond to his pleas, and he describes God as the God of his righteousness. God is the upholder of justice for his people. The idea is that God is the God who is going to bring righteousness and justice to David. He is going to bring about justice for David. And consequently, David does not need to resort to schemes against his enemies, although they are many and powerful. He does not need to resort to force or violence. God will vindicate him. God will deliver him. And so we see him in the psalm waiting on the Lord patiently in the midst of his trials. And the reason that he is able to do that is because he reflects back. He says of God, "You have relieved me." And at whatever point, whatever conflict we might want to think about with regard to David, whether we think the background of this is Absalom or we think the background of this is his struggle with Saul, David had reason to reflect back and remember the deliverance of the Lord. As early as 1 Samuel 17, David said that the Lord had delivered him from the mouth of the lion and the mouth of the bear. Even while he was a young shepherd in the field, he had experienced the deliverance of the Lord God. And so he is able to say, "You have relieved me." And then he again brackets this with another plea, "Be gracious to me and hear my prayer." He is crying out for God to graciously and abundantly provide the deliverance that he so desperately needs and so confidently trusts in. And then in 4:2, there's a marked contrast. The attitudes of his enemies are addressed. He says, "O sons of men, how long will my honor, or perhaps my glory, become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception?" The word honor here is literally glory. And students of this psalm have questioned whether, obviously, the New American Standard applies it to David. Is David's honor, his character that is being assaulted by his enemies? But some people would translate this glory and say that David's true glory is God himself, and that shame is being brought on the name of the Lord because of what David's enemies are doing to the Lord's anointed. And so it is possible that David's concern here is not so much for his own honor, his own reputation, but for God's glory. In any case, David's role as the anointed of the Lord means that his honor and God's glory cannot ultimately be separated. And David's enemies indeed have done what David would never do because he trusted in the Lord. They have a totally different approach. Again, we will consider some statements from both of the major events in David's life where he is surrounded by enemies. David said to Saul in 1 Samuel 26:23, "The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed." David is not going to take matters into his own hand. That is one of the primary indications of his faith. He's not going to resort to schemes. And he is certainly not going to trust in what is worthless. That is what he asked in Psalm 42. How long will you love what is worthless? Very often in the Old Testament literature, the thing that is worthless is the idol. And whether or not this is literal idolatry, whether or not his enemies are bowing down before Baal or something of that sort, or whether it's a more metaphorical idolatry where they are trusting in their own strength and their own might and their own wisdom and their own schemes, is really immaterial. It is idolatry nonetheless. And my suspicion is that they are, in fact, trusting in their own strength and their own schemes and their own plans. Remember Ahithophel's counsel in 2 Samuel 16:21, when David has fled from Absalom and his former friend, confidant, and advisor Ahithophel goes to Absalom, and he says to him in 2 Samuel 16:21, "Go in to your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Then all Israel will hear that you've made yourself odious to your father. The hands of all who are with you will also be strengthened." A stark line. And so Ahithophel is conspiring against David to bring shame on him and trying to secure his enemy Absalom's place. Not too long after this, Ahithophel says in 2 Samuel 17:1-3. Please let me choose 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and exhausted and terrify him so that all the people who are with him will flee. Then I will strike down the king alone and I will bring back all the people to you. The return of everyone depends on the man you seek. Then all the people will be at peace. And so again, Ahithophel seeks to destroy David, to take matters into his own hands. At the same time, David refused any advantage that he might take. In 2 Samuel 15:24-26, you may remember that Zadok comes out with the Ark of the Covenant and tells David, "We'll go with you." And David says, "No, you won't. You take the ark back. If the Lord brings me back, then the Lord will bring me back." David is not going to steal off in the night with the Ark of the Covenant in some vain attempt to force God's hand, or at least force the appearance of God's favor in his time of trouble. He won't do it. He's going to trust in the Lord. He's not going to try and use a lever. He's not going to scheme a scheme. He's not going to return evil for evil. He rests on the Lord and challenges all those who do otherwise. Such is his absolute confidence in God. And that absolute confidence is expressed in the center of the psalm when he says in Psalm 4:3, "Know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him." Now, remember his initial plea, "Answer me when I call." He now affirms that God does, in fact, answer him when he calls. That God has set apart the godly man for himself. The word godly is the adjective form of chesed. Chesed is a word that is often translated, when it's translated about God, as loving kindness. But it literally suggests the idea of covenant faithfulness. And so when David speaks about the godly man, he is speaking about the man who is faithful to God's covenant. He is speaking of the faithful man. And David says, God has set apart or sanctified the man who is faithful to the covenant. And in view of this, David is confident in the faithfulness and attentiveness of the Lord. David says, "I know that God is faithful to those who are faithful to him." He then again turns and gives counsel to those who hear us. He says, "Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still." Of course, this is the passage that is quoted in Ephesians 4:26. "Be angry and do not sin." The word trembling is understood in a couple of ways. The trembling is literal. Some understand the trembling to be repressed anger. Anger held in. Others understand trembling to be fear. Whether you take it to be fear or anger, and I think Ephesians 4:26 would encourage us to take it as anger. Paul certainly took it that way, and I think he is a sufficient guide in such matters. These situations may indeed provoke anger, and undoubtedly David is feeling that. And yet, he is not going to allow his anger to provoke him to respond to his enemies in kind. Instead, he is going to meditate in his heart upon his bed. He is going to think about the God of justice and righteousness and turn his circumstances over to the God of justice and righteousness and be still in the midst of the turmoil of his circumstances, in the midst of his sense of betrayal, as he is overwhelmed with the injustice of his enemies. He finds peace, stillness, calmness in the knowledge of a just, faithful, loving, and attentive God who knows his struggle and who is faithful to his people. And then he counsels further those who engage in such meditation to offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. These sacrifices are not offered because we have to do something to get God to respond. They are not offered because God somehow needs the sacrifices. As God says in Psalm 50, the cattle on 1,000 hills are mine. If I was hungry, I would not tell you. He doesn't need anything from his people. On the contrary, David understands and seeks to teach us and all those who will hear that we offer sacrifices not because God needs the sacrifices, but because we need to offer them. This is done in the spirit of the sacrifices in consecration, burnt offerings, which are a sacrifice of absolute commitment. Sin offerings, sacrifices of confession, fellowship offering, peace offerings, offered with a desire for harmony with God and an expression of trust in God. Those who give themselves over wholly and completely to the Lord are going to be delivered ultimately and finally. And then in the latter part of the psalm, in 6 through 8, we have another contrast here. This time the contrast is not so much David and his enemies as David and those around him who are perhaps undergoing the same set of circumstances that David is undergoing. He says, many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. So those around David are saying, who is going to show us any good? It is tempting in times of trouble to think that nothing good can come. This situation is so bad, so unjust, so terrible, and I'm suffering so much that no good can possibly come out of this situation. I want us to think back on a couple of situations, of both of which are situations of terrible injustice and betrayal. The first one is Joseph's situation. His own brothers threw him in a pit, considered murdering him, and sold him into slavery. And yet David says in Genesis 50:20, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." And so Joseph says, in no uncertain terms, God took this terrible situation, and he knew all too well how terrible it was. He had spent some 13 years, roughly, either as a slave or a prisoner, forgotten, reviled, falsely accused. And yet, in reflection, he says, God meant it for good. But there is a far greater injustice that Peter discusses in Acts chapter 2, beginning in verse 22. "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death." That is the greatest injustice that's ever been done. Jesus was nailed to the cross by the hands of godless men. He was put to death. For no crime of his own, no sin of his own, no shortcoming on his part, he was murdered. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. And so the greatest injustice ever perpetrated by man resulted in the greatest good ever realized by God. Now that tells us something. What that tells us is there is no such thing as an irredeemable set of circumstances. There is no situation so terrible that God cannot bring forth something great and glorious from it. And the amazing thing is that David had that confidence long before it was so powerful, that reality was so powerfully demonstrated in the cross. David believed that God could do good. Everybody around him saying, "Oh, there's nothing. This is awful. This is terrible." And David says, "No. What you need to do is you need to pray. And you need to pray that God will lift up the light of his countenance upon us." He says, "Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord." David's confidence is that all God needs to do is to look in our direction and all will be made well. All God needs to do is take notice of our injustice and all will be made right. All God needs to do is to acknowledge us, and his very presence will mean restoration. He goes on to say, "You have put gladness in my heart more than when grain and new wine abound." David's gladness transcends the gladness of circumstance, the gladness of grain and new wine. Obviously, the Israelites would celebrate at the harvest. They would celebrate God's provision, God's bounty, and it's easy to celebrate the good times. But But David finds gladness of heart not in a set of circumstances, but in the light of the Lord's countenance. It is enough for David to know that the Lord is with him regardless of what's going on around him and regardless of how much despair is going on around him. It does not matter how much his peers sing the blues. David finds peace and joy in the knowledge that he is loved and cared for by God. He says, "In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety." David's peace comes not from a change in circumstance. David's peace comes from the knowledge that God does not change, that he is forever faithful and true. And so while his enemies pursue him and his former friends scheme against him and his compatriots abandon hope, David is at peace in the knowledge that God hears him and loves him. He knows his Father. And his Father is our Father. Do you have peace today? Are you confident? And in what does that peace and confidence, if you have it, in what does that peace and confidence stand? Is it in a set of good circumstances? The danger of happiness is that it is dependent on what's happening. The peace of joy is that it transcends circumstances and finds its roots and foundation in the God of peace. The God who makes us whole, who strengthens us and sustains us, who is just and righteous, a vindicator of his people, and one who will punish the wicked who afflict us. David knew peace. Not because all his troubles had gone away, not because his enemies had ceased, but because his God is true. Our God is true. And that is our peace. That is our hope. That is the thing that sustains us. If you have not been set apart by this God, if you are not his child, then you can know no lasting peace in this world. The circumstances of this world, the things that men trust in ultimately, like the idols that David spoke of, are worthless. We would call you to put your faith in God through Jesus Christ, to believe in Jesus, to repent of your sins, confess him as Lord, and be baptized. If you're a Christian and you're struggling and you're wondering where this peace can be found, if we can help you or encourage you or pray for you, come now as we stand and as we sing.